My name's Kasky. I am an SRE at Google. I formerly was in one of our internal monitoring groups. I just got an email about an hour ago that I'm finally switched to a different manager, and I'm now in a different group where I'm working on some of our business intelligence pipelines. But what I'm going to talk about here is how we updated our monitoring infrastructure's automated release process to basically make it more reliable, more consistent, and easier to manage. So the environment that we were dealing with was a collection of several hundred servers that were situated all around the world. Basically, we had monitoring probe machines in every Google office, every Google data center, and usually primaries and spares. And a lot of people don't know that Google has around 130 offices worldwide. Our monitoring infrastructure extends into every single one of those offices, both for our back office monitoring to make sure that basic corporate services are up, but also for applications that want to know how their response time is from different places around the world. We can utilize our Google infrastructure, our offices, to originate those requests. But there was a very small team of about five of us that were responsible for this monitoring infrastructure. We have a configuration management database that enumerates every single one of these servers. When we're provisioning the machines, we first enter in the configuration management database. Then when the host is provisioned, it's able to look into that to see what it's supposed to do. These are Debian-based or Debian-based machines, and so we used apt for all of our software distribution. And we had an internal team-specific repository that our builds went into. And the key thing is the software that was used to build our monitoring infrastructure is a blend of three different kinds of software. Obviously, there's the free open source software that's part of the operating system and part of the base build, which has its own security update cycle. We have what I call in-house third party. These are products that are built by other teams than ours at Google that we incorporate into our monitoring nodes. And then, of course, there's the team-owned software, the software that we built just for our own uses that solve our problems and sometimes consumed by other outside entities. Obviously, the open source base updates as often as the security repo gets updated. The third-party software that we use internally, they have their own entire release management pipeline where they'll send out announcements. Okay, there's a new build of this available. The test builds are available here. You can transition to it, and then a full release would be made, and then it would be upon us to pick up that new release, repackage it, and ship it, because the packaging models used by these other teams were an internal Google package manager that's designed for our production environment, whereas these machines live in a more traditional corporate environment, so we use apt for the management of them. And so we'd have to extract the binaries from that package and repackage them in an apt-compatible way for distribution to our machines. And finally, our own software on a weekly basis, we're constantly making improvements and pushing out bug fixes and making changes and feature enhancements. Our servers themselves, they existed in one of three states at any given point in time. The building state is obviously when it hasn't yet been configured and installed. It's a fairly short-lived state. Essentially, that's the time between hardware or virtual machines were provisioned and we got about running the Puppet config to go and install our software on it. Then they spend the majority of their lifetime in the production mode, where essentially they are either servicing active requests for our infrastructure, or they're a hot spare because we would fail over roles between them. Each of these couple hundred nodes had a unique identity and a separate configuration that they were responsible for, and we needed one and only one instance of every configuration running, and so if a machine was going down for maintenance or something, we'd fail it out to another spare, which is why the fleet was so large. Even though we only had 130 offices, there were hot spares for everything, and we had an automatic failover manager that takes care of a lot of that stuff. And then finally, a failed state. Anytime a machine was getting wonky, either because it's a canary track that was running a bad build, or the hardware failed, or the site failed, we would mark it failed, and that would trigger a failover to another machine. The old release process consisted of our on-duty person. We had two rotations in our five-person team. On-call dealt with pages and emergent interrupt alerts that were occurring due to a failure in the production environment. But on-duty was basically responsible for the drudge work. It's a whole bunch of manual tasks that needed to be done just to keep the service alive and running. And one of them was to repackage the software and release it and do updates and upgrades. when they were doing provisioning, they would take the brand new machine. Now, we would provision about a new host every week to 2 weeks. Sometimes we'd have two or three new hosts a week. Sometimes we'd have zero for a week or two. But there was a turnover of about one new host a week that was either being brought up and another one's being brought down and so on, just to the regular operational churn of the service. And so the person on duty would have to go and SSH into the new machine and manually run a script which would bless it into the environment. And then, of course, part of that script would set up an automatic cron job that would take care of doing the apt-get update, an apt-get upgrade of all the software from the open source stack. They would also have to manually do the repackaging, as I said, of the third-party in-house software. And of course, they weren't responsible, though, for updating the team software, because the developer that was adding a new feature, they would be responsible for pushing a new build. All right, a terrible process, manual, error-prone. For the in-house software, the release process, sometimes it would be two or three times a quarter. Sometimes we would go 6 to 9 months without getting a new internal package. And so we'd literally forget, how is it that we go and repackage that again? Because each of the different pieces of software we'd pick up had a slightly different method to, okay, you gotta unpack this one, pull out that binary, take this config file, move it over here, rebuild it. And every time this would come up, either the person who was doing it would do it by hand and figure it all out new and then document it, or write a one-off script that would do it and say, okay, this time we really are going to use the script again next time. But then when it comes up again, somebody else was doing it. So you yourself would only touch one of those packages about once a year, right? Because by the next time you were on call, when a quarter release came out, you might not be the person who was doing the repackaging, and there were several different packages that were released. And of course, because it was a crappy job, you're like, ah, I gotta repackage this thing for release. I'm kind of busy this week. I'm gonna pretend I didn't notice the email that said a new update's available and hope the next on-duty guy will get to it. And it's, you think you're a genius for coming up with this plan. The problem is other people on the team also have that plan. And so 4 weeks later, when you're back in the on-duty rotation, it's like still sitting there and waiting for you, because they know you did that. And so they're like, we'll just wait for this to come back around to you. And because it was a slow release cycle, it wasn't a critical update. These things, these are very gradual feature releases in some of these core pieces of software. It just needed to get out there. You know, the transition period between feature releases is like they'd release version N plus one of the software, and they would maintain the version N of the software for 6 months or 12 months before they deprecated it. And so you had a very large window to move over. And so we'd play this little game, passing it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and until someone would be like, oh, fine. Usually when two or three of the builds would stack up and they're able to just say, you know what, next 2 days are going to suck and I'm going to do all this work. And of course, our own team software. This is just our own tools and components that we wholly owned internally within our team. And as the regular development work was going on, when you're not on call or on duty, it would be up to the developer to, okay, they've finished doing the new feature enhancement or customer request to the software. They'd check it in, and then they would go and manually trigger a build process, generate a new package, push that out into the repo. And they'd also kind of be responsible for keeping an eye on it as it rolled out to make sure it didn't break anything and roll it back if it did. However, in the reality of software development, sometimes small features end up taking 3 or 4 weeks to get ready for release, or there's dependent features that need to be put in that someone else is working on. And so it wouldn't always be the case that once a feature was checked into revision control, a new build would immediately get put out. Instead, they'd be like, okay, I need to do this, but I need to wait to release this until something else happens or until a customer's ready. And so the next guy to put a feature in the same code base would put it into the feature, check it in, and then go and do a build, and he's now inadvertently released the other guy's new feature to the rest of it. And that's what I mean by no clear change log. It was never really sure. You could never really tell what were the things that you were bundling up in this release. And of course, since we didn't mark where the cut point was of each release, you couldn't just go and see, well, what was checked in between then and now. And so, terrible, terrible process, right? Yeah. Who uses processes like these still? Nobody? Awesome. I still do this for a bunch of things. Yeah. I mean, hopefully this is a state that everybody has moved well away from. But you're all very familiar with the types of pitfalls that come with that. So, It turns out we obviously were hating this entire model. We'd lived with it for several years, all right? But we said, okay, how can we fix this in a holistic way that eliminates all of the errors and all the problems that are coming up with it? And so we looked at what resources were already available to us, and we did a few minor sins with them. The first is our revision control system that we have in-house. Every time code is committed to it, it automatically triggers the unit tests to run a full build of the software, and it runs all of the tests, and it then produces a green or red based upon how many of the tests pass, right? And this is an internal developed tool that we have. It's much like using Jenkins or Hudson. Is Hudson the new name or is Jenkins the new name? Jenkins is the new name. It's much like using that, where each commit triggers a run of the unit tests and the integration tests. Since you can query what the latest green build label is and then go and get all the metadata about that, you can basically find the assets that were associated with that build. Now, the continuous integration system wasn't designed for doing release management. We have other tools that are more designed for doing release management, but we didn't want to use those because they were more complex. We were a very small team, and those tools were designed for much bigger, hairier problems than our team was dealing with. So we didn't want to get into our actual release management software, of which we have several different flavors that are available internally. So, because the continuous integration system only is designed for running tests, what we did was we created a fake test target in the build rules that tests that the apt package was built correctly. It just runs apt-v or whatever on it. It verifies that the file's well-formed. But what that does is that tricks the test runner to build the dependency of the apt package for us. So that is how we induce it to generate new apt packages on every single commit that impact our code, because the test running environment is smart enough to only find the tests that are impacted downstream by a code change. So it would see that, oh, this depends upon the apt package, that depends upon this source file, which was modified in this commit, and so it would run that test, which would cause the apt package to get created. We then took our big fat apt package, which was our service, and we broke it into three logical parts. We had the server role package, which was a pure meta package. We had the daemon package, which only ever contained just the executable binary. And then we had what we call a config package, which is kind of what glued it all together. So the role package, those were named identically to what the configuration management system said this server's role is. Okay? What its purpose is that when we do use Puppet to turn up our hosts, every time a new host is provisioned, a Puppet job runs on it to basically do the basic infrastructure initialization. We added one small Puppet configuration section, which at the end of all of the other usual host assembly type things says, okay, now query the configuration management database with your host name, and you'll get some string back that says what your role is. Now, apt-get install that thing as a package name, and that's the meta package, and it would then depend upon the package that contains the daemons that you need and the package that contains the configuration for your service. We weren't comfortable working in Puppet because the way Puppet's managed or was managed at the time, it would require us to have a separate release process for Puppet and versus our release process for our code. So we decided to roll all of our configuration into an apt package, because then we only had one kind of thing that we were building and releasing on a regular basis, our apt packages. The daemon package, this was primarily to help us with the repackaging of the third-party in-house software. Essentially, we need to be able to pull out just the executable and put it in something that we could update and release on a regular cycle that relates to the release pattern of our in-house third-party products. And as they are building their new versions and adding features to it, this automatically would get rebuilt and repackaged and released. That actually moved us ahead of their release cycle in a few cases, because we were picking up changes as soon as they were committed. And of course, the fake unit test depends upon that binary, which causes the test system to generate the build. It might have been said on a previous slide, but our test system retains copies of every artifact built during every test run, and so we can go back and say, give me the apt package that was generated as a dependency of this previous test run, even if it's been a day or two or whatnot. It just stores all of the side effects and, of the test run. And then, of course, the config package, as I said. Once that config package gets installed, and it depends upon the binary, and the meta package depends upon it, the server is up and running and live. Basically, the moment that package installation completes, it's a live server. And for those that aren't familiar with RIAA, anyone familiar with resource initialization? Sorry, it should be RAII. Should be RAII. Resource acquisition is initialization. Okay. Basically, that means it's a concept from software engineering where the moment you construct an object, it should be ready to use, and it should fail to be created in the first place if it isn't going to be able to finish initializing. So instead of get an object and then call set this, turn on that, and activate initialize, and you get the error down here, you have one line which actually makes a fully formed thing ready to go. So we applied that concept to our servers that the moment the apt-get install of the meta package completes, the server's live and running. There's no second step. It's basically install it, and the server's live. And the config package contains everything that most people would put into Puppet or CF Engine or Chef or something like that. Again, because we wanted to have one kind of thing that we were releasing. So it also, the launch scripts, all the different flags that were set on the command line. We made our launch scripts smart enough to look at the host and figure out what its config is. So instead of us putting config files on it, the startup script is smart enough to figure out what configuration options need to be set based upon the environment that it's running in. So if you were actually to rename a host, it would, at the next restart, basically configure itself differently because of the information it found at startup time. And so instead of having static config files, the launch scripts configure the software on the fly. And that allows us to make changes like we can make a tweak in the configuration management system that adjusts a role, and just by bouncing the server, it then picks up the new data without us having to push out a new config file or release anything. And of course, the config package depends upon the binary, and that makes it all, makes the magic happen. So we have three repositories: testing, unstable, stable, and old stable. We only really use three in the fully automated release process. We used to have four because during the manual process, when you'd make an error, you needed to have a copy of the old binary and old stable that you could pull back into stable. But that's not really used anymore in the fully automated model because it's easier to roll forward than roll backward. That was something I talked about at the last summit, about always rolling forward. Who was at the last summit? Anyone? Oh, wow, there's all new people. Oh, this is awesome. Good job, Dinah. I could have just recycled what I said last time. Yeah. All right, fine. what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So the testing repo, the very last step of the build, of the unit test, okay, that, remember I said we had that thing that was a fake unit test that just checked to see if the apt file succeeded. Right after it checks to see if the apt file was built correctly, it pushes it into the testing repo as a side effect of running that test. And so we automatically, because our unit testing engine doesn't have a rule that says, okay, now copy this to a repo. So instead we wrote a very thin little test driver that all it does is copy it into the repo as the last step of the test. And it says, test succeeded. And of course, it wouldn't even get that far if something had failed earlier in the testing cycle. So we push always into testing. Every single build goes into testing. It just collects new versions over and over and over and over again. And then every Wednesday, we have a special server that we run whose job it is simply on Wednesdays to pull to testing. I'm sorry, to pull to unstable from testing. All right. Now, the previous day on Tuesday, unstable is pulled to stable automatically. And so the build that's been in unstable since last Wednesday gets pushed out live on Tuesday, and then the next day the new candidate for between Tuesday and Wednesday the entire fleet's running the same version of software. On Wednesday though, the canary fleet gets the new unstable version and it upgrades. And so if something goes weird on Tuesday, we know that we missed something in canary and the fleet's all of a sudden going to go wonky. We need to roll back. If something goes weird on Wednesday on the canary machines, we know that there's something wrong with the build that's about to come out. And then, of course, old stable, we don't use it anymore, though. I think our scripts still keep copying builds into that just because it was part of our workflow and it was all manual, and so we duplicated that. Host updates are managed by a very sophisticated piece of code, which simply every 12 hours runs a command that looks spiritually similar to this, where it sleeps for a random time between 0 and 12 hours, and then runs apt-get update and apt-get dist upgrade. And that causes every machine in the fleet every 12 hours to do a full upgrade. Okay. Now, because we use the repos to separate out our canary fleet from our production fleet, canary machines are ordinary machines in our fleet. Okay, they basically are responsible for production loads, but they're always running the next candidate version of software. But because we can, if there's something wrong with them, we can fail them and reshift their workload over to non-canary machines. It's very easy for us to see when problems occur, and we have separate alerting rules that monitor our canary fleet. They're the same rules that monitor our canary fleet as they do our production fleet. They're just tagged and routed differently, so we immediately know that, oh, the machine that's alerting now is one of our canary machines, so you've got to be suspect of the new software that's going to be released next week. And since we wanted about 1 in 20 of our machines to be on the canary track, but we wanted to be consistent that this machine, if it gets re-imaged or something, it would end up being on the same track. A coworker of mine came up with this delightfully simple hack of just hashing the host name, and you check to see if the first character of the hash of the host name is an A, and that would automatically give you about 1 in 16 of your machines on the other track. So in the Puppet config, right before it picks which apt repo to install in the sources, it does this check, and then you either get the the unstable track repo if you are an A, or you get the other one if all other cases. And so it's nice in that as machines get re-imaged, you don't suddenly have different machines that were canary machines last week, but now they're not canary machines, but you still get a semi-random distribution of that. It works well enough. It's one of those things that, you know, it's good enough. And so we get some of our fleet on the canary track and some on the main track. All right, so any change in the source revision control system? Yeah?
Why don't you want to have it randomized?
No, we do want it randomized, but we don't want, if we reimage a machine, for it to suddenly, last week it was a canary machine, now it's a stable machine. Because from an operations perspective, you get kind of used to knowing the names of the machines that are canary machines. And so if Ann Arbor, Michigan server 1 was canary last week, it's probably canary still this week. You know, you kind of build up this mental model of all the machines. Because we did have it just randomly. We used random and a percentage. But we found that it became confusing because, you know, you just had to do extra work when doing your on-call response to the, okay, now which machine is this, and look for the label that says whether it's stable or unstable. When they're consistent, then you just be like, oh, it's Ann Arbor, you know, or it's Bolivia, or, you know, you just get a feel for what they are, and that's why you want them to be random but consistent. So changes to the source revision control system automatically get pushed out. Since we manage our configs for our service via apt packages, as soon as we've made a change to it, we don't have to wait for something like a puppet or a chef run to kick off. Instead, the new apt package gets built, pushed out on Wednesday to the canary fleet, Tuesday to the production fleet. We do use Puppet to provision because that infrastructure is provided for us by another team at our company, where they use Puppet to do the baseline provisioning of the machine, and so we just tacked that one rule onto that. We've had to modify our Puppet config twice in 2 years, I think, just to deal with some minor packaging. They changed how their hierarchy of Puppet configs, and none of us are Puppet masters. We, you know just enough to be dangerous, and so we try and stay away from it as much as we can. And upstream changes, we automatically pick them up. No more manually repackaging of our coworkers' code. And Tuesday madness. Everyone, whoever's on call knows that if something goes wrong on Tuesday, it's probably a build. And if something goes wrong on Wednesday, it's a pending build. We do have a way of when we do detect a failure, it's a very simple remediation process. For the canary fleet, one of the easiest things to do is just go into the unstable repo and purge the version, because if it hasn't yet rolled out to the entire canary fleet, then that keeps it from rolling out to more. You can optionally fix it right away. If it's something simple, like there was a typo that was missed by the unit tests, then you can do a quick fix, because it's Wednesday sometime during the day. your Canary fleet starts indicating that the build's bad as it begins to roll out to the Canary fleet. And you're like, oh crap, I need to make a fix. You spend the rest of the day Wednesday, maybe Thursday, figuring out what's wrong. You put the fix in on Thursday, and then you do a manual pull from the testing repo into unstable, and now the Canary fleet's running this hot-fixed version, and next week's release will go off without a hitch. Okay. For the stable one, it's a little bit more urgent because there are more machines, and so the rollout occurs much more rapidly, even though it takes 12 hours for the entire fleet to update with several hundred machines. That's a machine every few minutes. And usually when you're on call, you can see that there's a graph that all of a sudden starts stair-stepping down as it rolls out. And when you see that pattern, you know you need to immediately stop the rollout. And so you go in and move old stable back to stable, which would prevent the rollout, or you just purge the package. And then you just go in and you manually fix up the machines that are busted. Because we can very easily fail over to our spares, we just fail out of all of those production machines onto spares. And then the easiest thing to do is just re-image the machines that had the bad package, and they'll come back up. They'll then pick up the same track they were on before. It's just faster and a simple. We can, in one command on the command line, re-image the machine, but to SSH in and you know, move the package back is too many manual steps. And so it's a little for loop that re-images all those machines is the fastest and easiest way to get around that. It's using a sledgehammer to kill a fly, but it's fast and easy. And when they come back online because of RAII, they'll immediately take back over their original roles and the spares will go back to being spares. So, before versus after, inconsistent releases, very large version shear. This weird phrase I just made up to represent the fact that what goes out in any one release could be an extremely, you could be rolling up many, many, many different changes instead of just one or two changes. The fleet, because of the manual release process, could end up, we have multiple third-party packages that we repackage, and they kind of get released in lockstep, but if someone doesn't release this one for one or two releases, but this one is kept up to date, we can end up with slightly mismatched and incompatible versions of these external programs. Obviously, releases get delayed tremendously when we're using a manual process. And of course, when you aren't sure how much code you're bundling up, when it could be two or three other developers have made additional feature enhancements that weren't released, you can end up not really knowing what it is you're releasing. You get this big release that has several flag flips and a few other things that are going on. And of course, after all this stuff, releases happen automatically. It's just magic. After about 6 months or so, when our unit testing, it boosts the quality of our unit testing as we find things that aren't caught by our unit tests. After about 6 months, this system would go months without us ever having to look at it or do a manual rollback or anything, because it would just release software automatically. And we were managing our fleet by just turning up new hosts and turning down old ones, and the software was all coming out automatically. Very nice stuff. And of course, when something does go wrong, it's very obvious what to do. This host is bad, fail it, rebuild it. There isn't the complexity of having to go and find in the old stable the version that was broken, bring it back, or roll forward, and so on. Of course, incremental updates. We all loved the on-duty workload going down, and just needed to keep an eye on when things happen on Tuesday, that means something special. Excuse me. Of course, we discovered new failure modes. There's always new failure modes when you bring up a new system. The big red button, something that halts the rollout process. That's, I think, week two we figured out we needed that. Week one, hey, it worked just the way we thought. Go away, and I was like, oh God, we need to stop it. And don't forget that it's Tuesday. I'll always remember that it's Tuesday. And because the system was so stable after the first year or so, we really got out of the habit of even thinking about our release process. And sometimes it'd take a while to knock the dust off and realize, oh wait, no, there's something wrong with the rollout. Quick, stop it. And of course, we discovered that it created some anti-patterns in our workflow. Right after we did start using it, people would begin to rush to get features in before the Wednesday cutoff to pull to unstable because they really wanted their stuff to get out, and that would cause errors because they'd check in something they weren't 100% on and they'd get a busted build or a broken piece of code. The ideal thing is a busted build because then the cutoff would take the previous green build from before they checked that in and move it over to unstable. And because we'd automated all of these pulls to the different levels, we had a simple one-click thing that could then manually do that step that the automated thing was doing. And so for a few months, we got in the bad habit of, you know what, I'm just going to click and do it manually. It's Thursday, and I've got one more feature that I didn't get in the cutoff yesterday, but I'm going to go ahead and promote to the Canary fleet manually because I really want this to go out. And it took a while for us to realize that, no, that's not something we want to do. Be more calm in our release of features because our customers didn't need features on a weekly basis. These features would go months between being opened and when we would release it. So if it didn't make this week, so what? You know, relax, take a step back and realize, check it in, let it bake in the Canary fleet like it's supposed to for a week, and then let it go out. So it's very tempting to just squeeze something in. And of course, the big red button, we have a change freezer on certain holidays, and being able to shut down the entire system for a period of a couple weeks during change freezes was important so that the automated updates wouldn't automatically pick up software changes, because the change freeze doesn't apply to making software changes in the revision control system, it applies to pushing those out to production. And so fully automated releasing needs the way to be stopped. And then, so once we had the big red button, that was the important thing that allowed us to, during change freezes, restrict releases. And so that's what I said in one slide. I got RAII right on this slide. So that's how we did it, and it worked great for a couple of years. And then we turned the entire service down because it was an easier way to do the whole thing with like two machines. I this is a weird time because I proposed this talk back when we were still doing all of this stuff, and like I said, just today I've been moved to a different team. So I no longer do any of this. But we did it for 4 years, 3 years. So anyway, questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah.
So.
Yes.
That's correct, right? If it's not doing that, then is it simply just spinning up skeleton machines like, this is a Tomcat node?
The question was, if Puppet's not doing the application config, is it just spinning up the skeleton? In a nutshell, yes. We have a group that manages our machine images. What you say is this is a Puppet node was actually what we call our role, the role of this monitoring service being installed on this machine. So in our case, what it would do is Tomcat node. What would happen is the machine would be brought up, Puppet would do the things like the Kerberos configuration and the LDAP stuff and all that. It's other things that are managed by teams that aren't us. And then at the last step, it would say, okay, let's go look at the configuration management database and say, oh, you're supposed to be a Tomcat node. And it would say apt-get install Tomcat. Our named meta package after it had picked either the stable or unstable repo to add. It would say, okay, now apt-get install Tomcat server. And then that's the last step that Puppet would do, and all the rest of the config would come in through the apt packages. So some teams do use Puppet all the way down. They release their software using apt packages, but then do the configuration through a Puppet config. We decided not to do that because it would greatly expand the number of technologies we needed to manage with minimal benefit for us. So, I mean, our fleet's homogeneous, but every single role is unique. So, yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with Puppet. No other questions? Yeah.
So how do you manage the database? That also
our servers are stateless. He asked how I manage a database release. You gotta realize this particular situation isn't we're not releasing a web app stack, serving stack with a Memcache server, a database, an application server, and so on. This is a distributed fleet of machines that are all cooperating to provide a single particular kind of service. And the database that they make use of, the data that they make use of, is contained within the configuration managed packages, and also as part of their ongoing operation, they pull data from other services which contain data about what they're supposed to be doing according to their different roles. And so there's a data push that gets put out separately that these servers consume, but these servers don't store any novel data over long term. They gather a bunch of data and then they push it up into our production servers for long term storage and archiving. We roll forward, yeah. I talked about this at the last summit, and that is we tried doing rollbacks on occasion, but it turns out fighting with apt over what version of a package wants to be installed, we found that it's faster and easier to revert the change in the revision control system, check in the reversion of the change, let the test system build a new version with the new change, which is actually undoing the change that broke it, and release that as a new build. Because that was just faster and easier. All the parts are meant to turn in this direction, and so we just kept them turning in that direction, but changed what the source code was that was being released.
Let's roll forward.
Yeah. Yeah, so we always roll forward. Just because we have really good revision control system that allows us to, in one click, undo an entire commit. Once that's undone, it automatically gets committed, and the test system kicks off a build, and it gets put into the testing server repo automatically as a result of the test, and then we manually promote it to unstable or to unstable and to stable to force it out into the fleet. And then if we really, really want the fleet to update right now, if it's super emergency, then we just use a for loop and SSH into every machine and force it to do an upgrade. Otherwise, they're all going to update in the next 12 hours. And so very rarely have we had to force an upgrade on a fleet-wide basis to roll forward. Almost always, the kinds of problems we run into are solved better by failing the machines that have the bad build. They fail over to the old build, which was good, while they then upgrade to the skipped to ahead version, which rolls back the change that the bad code had. And once they're all synchronized back up, because of the RAII, the failed hosts now all of a sudden take back over their old roles as soon as they reinstall. Because every time they reinstall, they're like, wait, why am I not doing the role I'm supposed to be doing? Give it back to me. I'm not, the spare shouldn't have it.
So, just so I have it correct, you guys were pushing by a job to the apt-get repo for all pre-production, which automatically means that they're just constantly pulling the latest package, right?
Yes, yeah.
And then production was what, a button push that would then push that to the apt-get repo?
Our old model?
Or the new one?
No, the new model is fully automatic. The repos get updated all the way to production. The repos get updated automatically on a scheduled basis. Every Wednesday, we pull from the testing repo, which nothing follows. And it just contains the latest green builds versioned by the time they were built. It pulls every Wednesday from the testing repo into the unstable repo, which the Canary fleet tracks. Then on Tuesday, we pull from the unstable repo into the stable repo, which the rest of the fleet tracks. And so from Wednesday through the following Tuesday, the Canary fleet runs a different version of software, the next version of software. And then from Tuesday through the following Tuesday, the production fleet runs whatever version the Canary fleet was running last week.
So you guys are doing continuous deployment to
production, unless that big red button's pushed? Yes. Yeah, continuous deployment to production, unless the big red button's pushed. But, well, it's continuous scheduled deployment. I mean, some people do continuous where it is every single release, but no, this is continuous deployment of on Wednesday so that we know that it's, that we're batching up our changes. Theoretically, we could speed it up, but we really need enough time to notice there's something wrong with the Canary fleet. So that's why we chose Wednesday and then Tuesday. Yeah. For our repos? We were using, just the regular apt repository managers for a long time, and I believe Thomas Bushnell gave a talk at PuppetConf where he described our internal apt server It's basically, it appears to be an apt server, but behind the scenes it's completely different software. But it's internal software. Since I don't know if he gave that talk or not, I can't really say a lot more than that, but essentially it appears to be an ordinary apt server, and it uses the same tools on the front end, but behind the scenes it's a completely different animal. It lives inside of our production data centers. The question was, are all the versions in the repos? Our configuration always says install the latest. And that's makes things like roll forward the way to go, because as long as there's a higher version, higher numbered version of the package in the repo, it'll pick it up automatically as part of the upgrade. Nothing else? Yay, all right, thank you very much.